Hello, this is Millie Long, co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and I'm pleased for this podcast to welcome Dr. Gary Lichtenstein, who's professor of medicine, vice chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, and director of development and philanthropy for the University of Pennsylvania. Gary, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Millie, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
Well, our goals today are to review some of the content from the recent ACG Crohn's disease guideline. This was the first update in 5 years, and I know you and your team of authors had to put together a lot of new information in the Crohn's disease space.
There's been an explosion in medical therapy for treating individuals with Crohn's disease, and the big question is how to interpret the data. You see many commercials on TV, many commercials in magazines, and the question is, what's right for me and what's best for me, not only for just medical therapy, but for all aspects of Crohn's. And this will hopefully serve as a nice resource for people to go to, along with the ACG as educational material, the Crohn's Colitis material for the Crohn's Colitis Foundation, and other societies as well. So this will add to the soup.
Oh, I think it'll be really helpful. And I wanted to highlight just a few questions, you know, from the patient perspective surrounding your guidelines that I think may be helpful for them. You know, one of the things you do in the guideline is you really describe something called disease phenotype, which is a fancy word for saying where does the Crohn's affect the patient and what type of Crohn's it is. And so is there a linkage between the type of Crohn's disease you have and the risk of complications? And how should a patient be educated on their type of Crohn's disease?
So it's a critical question and very important. And Crohn's disease, just to review, is a disorder of inflammation of the bowel that can affect anywhere in the intestinal tract, from the mouth down into including the anus. And some of the more common sites that it may occur is the area where the large and the small bowel meet, called the ileocolic area. So the ileum meets the colon, the cecum in that region, directly. And this is one of the more common sites where complications can come about. Given the ileum is the narrowest portion of the bowel, it may be the most likely to end up blocked from inflammation, lowering the ability of material to pass through because it's narrow in that area. And perhaps you can also get what's called fistulae, where the inflammation burrows outside of the bowel into the abdomen. Another area is the rectal area. So perianal disease, around, peri means around, anal is the anum, and you can get what's called fistulas, areas that drain in the skin, in the anal area from the bowel, and it can have pus, mucus, or even stool come out. And this is an area that's especially prone to have a more aggressive form of disease. These are the big areas that we talk about. There's certainly other areas that can be involved. And when this is present, it's important to seek medical care to get appropriate attention and start on the appropriate course of therapy.
Absolutely. And I think, Gary, you highlighted some important aspects that I think each patient with Crohn's should know. You know, where is their disease located? Could be the small bowel, the large bowel, as you mentioned, and particularly whether it involves the perianal area. And then what type it is. Is it inflammatory, meaning just kind of inflammation and not cause damage yet, or narrowings, blockages, or even those fistula that you talked about? Because they really do change how we might manage patients with Crohn's disease and change our therapeutic strategy. So I think the guideline is helpful to outline that for providers, you know, as well as patients, that understanding that type of disease becomes very important.
And I'll add one other thing, that many times we treat disease that's inflammatory. There's inflammation in the bowel, in the area where the ileum and the colon meet, and one can get scar tissue after that, a stricture. If it's a small stricture, we highlight in the guidelines as well, one can do what's called endoscopic dilation. So to go into the area where there's narrowing and with a colonoscope, go ahead and stretch it open. And that's successful. In about a third of patients, approximately, there may be benefit from that. So it's something that can help avoid surgery if it's not too long. If it's too long, then it's something that is amenable to endoscopic treatment and would mandate surgery.
Well, and so that leads into my very next question. In some instances, patients with Crohn's do require surgery. So there's always choice after surgery of whether to go on a medication right away to try to prevent kind of a recurrence of that inflammation, or maybe to wait and see, you know, how that patient may do. To guide that, we often think about risk factors. And so what should a patient know about their own risk factors for having a recurrence after surgery?
Well, the first thing that's important is to say that many people get recurrence, and we define recurrence in many ways. There could be symptom recurrence that is after surgery, and it may not be due to disease. One can have infections. One can have what's called bile salt diarrhea. If the bowel is resected, the bile and the colon can come down and lead to diarrhea without actually being Crohn's itself. And that may be treated with a medicine that just mops up the bile, if you would, and lessens the chance that it's going to lead to diarrhea. But you may also have mild, moderate, or severe recurrence. And we grade that based upon the colonoscopy and doing an MRI or a CT enterography, which are x-rays that look, or an MRI is not an x-ray, but it's an imaging scan that looks at the bowel to see if there's inflammation. If the amount of recurrence is very mild, then observation can be the course to take with close follow-up with labs or endoscopic procedures. And this is the approach that one might take. But things to do are, if you are an individual who smokes cigarettes, stop smoking. Very important, because that's one of the factors that clearly is associated with complications, let alone all the other risks, heart disease, lung cancer, et cetera. Don't take things called non-steroidals, ibuprofen, naproxen, other medications like this, whereas there is one medication not well defined, but celecoxib has not been shown to cause, quote, disease flares in ulcerative colitis, not in Crohn's. So that's something that we translate, perhaps that'll be safer to use, but it carries other risks. And these are some of the things that we would say are important to do. So close, careful follow-up with your health practitioner is important to see, is there any evidence of recurrence? And if so, to treat it very aggressively up.
No, I agree. It's so individualized. And so having a conversation with your doctor about what are my risk factors and am I someone who needs to start on a therapy immediately after surgery or can I do watchful waiting? And I think that the guidelines really help us in terms of outlining who those patient populations are. All right, I have one last question, which has to do with you describe in these guidelines beautifully a number of new medications that are available for Crohn's. There's a lot of excitement because we have choices. We have patients who may have responded to other medicines and now have options to respond to these newer therapies. But a lot of patients have questions surrounding the timing. So how much time does it take after starting a new medication for symptoms to improve or even endoscopy? I think that one of the things your guidelines mention is that we need to have two goals, which is that we want patients' symptoms getting better, but we also really want the bowel healed to help to prevent further complications from active Crohn's. So what are those timelines, just so patients can have an expectation?
So it's a great question, and it truly depends on many factors, but some general guidance is that symptoms may improve more rapidly than endoscopy. And we often think of going 6 to 9 months out at least to see has an endoscopic appearance gotten better in someone when they start a new medication. But we have biomarkers. These are markers in the blood and the stool that you can follow to see if they're going down. And this is something called a CRP and a calprotectin of the stool. And if they start at a high level and they start to drop, then that's a good sign that there may be advancing towards healing of the bowel or improvement. Symptoms, we say 4 to 8 weeks approximately, you should start to see some benefit. And often people will get treated if they have bad symptoms with a steroid. That's sometimes a four-letter word in people's armamentarium because of all the side effects, but it works rapidly. And it doesn't change the course of disease, but it enables time so people cannot have severe symptoms, and then allowing the medicine that they're trying, a biologic or a small molecule to start to work. And that gives them quality of life.
That's really helpful. And I agree with you, Gary. In some instances, the steroid is needed over the short term as a kind of band-aid to get you to effectiveness of the other therapy. And it's something to talk about with your providers. One key thing your guideline emphasizes and that I emphasize in practice is steroids alone are never the answer. It's kind of a short-term treatment to help to get someone on a more effective maintenance treatment. So with that, I can't believe we're out of time. There's so many more questions I know you could answer. For our patients who are listening, I would love to direct you to the ACG website at gi.org under the Patients tab, and you'll find more information there directed at patients from the American College of Gastroenterology that helps from an educational perspective. So, Gary, thank you so much for your time and for these huge efforts with these guidelines. Any last words for our patients listening?
I think it's important, Millie, to really follow up closely with your healthcare provider and let them know what you want. This is not just a provider giving you information where you have to say, it's shared decision making. So you, your provider, and your spouse or your significant other should also be someone to say, hey, let's talk about this together as a group and create a plan of appropriate attack. I think it's a concerted effort that should be made with all providers to do so.
Those are great recommendations, and I really encourage all of our patients to adhere to that. Recognize that the providers want you to be successful, and shared decision-making is so important. We want to be your advocates and partners, not someone dictating a plan. So I think that's great advice. Thanks again for joining us, Gary, and thanks again to our listeners.